So I'll be talking a little bit about frustrated and dimerized spin chains and the carrier dynamics. This is work that I have been doing in collaboration with a student of mine at Braunschweig. And the a rough schedule of the talk is just like that. I'll just very briefly motivate what I'll be talking about here, but I think with the very distinguished audience that I'm talking in front of, I will boil that down to a single view graph and then immediately jump to the two next topics. Then I'll just tell you a little bit about how we treat, so to speak, the spin in that title, and in the second part, how we go about and treat the carrier part in that title. So just very briefly, again, from a model point of view, many of the substances that we are discussing here in this workshop can, regarding their spin Hamiltonian, be more or less mapped onto models that have nearest and next nearest neighbor exchange interactions. They are dimerized and frustrated. So
the two interactions are of opposite sides.
Let me just go to that point here. Right. So essentially, the models that drive the spin part, the systems that we are interested in regarding their spin Hamiltonian are more or less related to models of this type. So we have, as I said, nearest and next nearest neighbor exchange interactions. Usually in many of the substances, they are the nearest neighbor ones are dimerized, just parameterized by some delta, and they are the next nearest ones are frustrated if the thing is positive. And of course, we can have substances where this thing gets negative, and one of them is down here. This is the lithium cuprate. So in this diagram that we have seen frequently, I think, throughout, at least while I was here throughout this workshop, is putting, so to speak, this is kind of a generic phase diagram which puts the spin gap, or the gap in the spin spectrum, onto a kind of a phase diagram as a function of the frustration parameter and the dimerization parameter of the spin system. And we can find many of the systems that are of interest to us in this phase diagram, if you want so. There are the ladder materials up here. Some of them are doped, as we have heard in Claudia's talk. Others are half-filled, partially doped, like the telephone number compounds. There are dimerized chain materials. Many organic materials reside on that line. And there's the copper germinate that we have heard about down here as a function of the frustration. I've placed it here in the critical or above the critical point here, but other people may place it down here. And there are systems which are non-frustrated in the sense that...
some of us who are outside of this charm circle, just recall quickly what are the sort of principal evidence for these spin Hamiltonian thing go right? I mean, how do we know that they are one dimensional? I mean, visually,
we saw
the crystal structures and they
right.
Look like it would play.
We have some evidence from first principles calculation. Actually, also the evidence that we get for the systems not being so well one-dimensional also come from these kinds of calculations. Like, for example, I learned here from Warren about this substance. I had always been putting that into a fairly one-dimensional systematics, but now I learned that this may not be true. And then, of course, we have lots of bulk thermodynamic measurements, like susceptibility and specific heat, which tell us...
it's temperature dependence of thermodynamic
properties.
So speaks of one dimension.
Right. And then, of course, in those systems which are carrier-doped, we have transport properties, like conductivity and things like that,
so
which tell us...
it's one-dimensional even in electronic.
Well, I mean, these systems are not really one-dimensional. They have rho C over rho A ratios of the order of 10 or 50 or so.
All right. Well, we wouldn't call that one-dimensional.
Okay, good.
I would say that most direct evidence for the insulating dynamic systems of a neutron scatter.
Yes.
And the other, because you can see it from the center, the other evidence is often ambiguous.
I don't have this nice figure with me, but I have it up in my office. I could talk about it. There is this neutron backscattering data, for example, which has been taken by the Japanese on the copper germinate system, which nicely shows the particles of a piece and continuum of the spinon, spinon excitations. So neutron scattering is also a nice evidence.
Sure, but I mean, this directly measuring
depends on the spin. And would that be true also of the phonons?
No. Probably almost all cases, they're not one, which is a problem.
And in some sense, also the neutron, in a very direct way, and I'll come back to that, tells us how far we have to astray from having these systems purely one-dimensional. This is also a fair indication of how one-dimensional they are.
Okay, I'm sorry, I hope.
No. I can just skip the rest of the graphs. There are many other, as I said already in this brief discussion, that we have many other axes to this so-called phase diagram, which have been of interest and have been studied in the past, like impurity doping, magnetic field, temperature. And there's one that we think is interesting. This is when it comes to doping the system with mobile carriers. And I told you that we were somehow interested in understanding angular resolved photo emission. Now, I learned that in principle for copper germinate, there's XPS data available. But XPS is a probe on an electron volt energy scale and more. And that is not what we are interested in. So when I'm talking about photo emission, I'm talking about energy scales of the order of J that we're interested in. So that is some 100 or 1,000 Kelvin. Okay, and so because we are interested in that, we are going to extend on this model in the second part of the talk in the sense that I will just add electron hopping terms to such models and study what will come out of that. But prior to doing that, I want to tell you how we model or crudely estimate the spin dynamics of the system. And we are biased, so to speak, by one point in this diagram, which is this point, where the system is fully dimerized. So the ground state is known, it's just a product of singlets. The excitations are also known, it's just a bunch of triplets that you excite, they don't interact with each other. And so that limit we are biased, so to speak, by. And this is how we sit. Now, this is a pretty busy slide, but it's just like a dictionary, so to speak, telling you what we do, and then I'll comment on what you would expect from such an approach. So we are biased by this point of complete dimerization of the system. In that limit, your spin system is just, it is convenient to think of the spin system not in terms of single side spin variables, but in terms of so-called bond spin variables. So you just combine two of the spins per dimer into a singlet or a triplet, right? And for that, you can then continue to do what you have. What
you material that would go into that particular point?
Excuse me, I didn't.
It would be a material of those you listed, but those exactly to that.
Oh, exactly.
Which one would be fully dimerized? Which one is like
there are some organic substances which have very strong dimerization, and I put them on here.
Not the ones that are inorganic.
Well, the FOPO is not really up here, actually. The FOPO is far down here. So I would go for organic substances.
And the germinate is?
The germinate is frustrated. It's down here.
As
we learned, there's a spin piles transition in the system which drives a finite delta.
So it's somewhere in that.
That's a little bit up here, like 5% or 2%, depending. Yeah, this is right. So this is so to speak a diagram at zero temperature. At finite temperature above the spin piles, I would have to place the copper germinate. So at present, answering this question more thoroughly, at this point, I don't make any assumption about the material or approximation. You can do that with any spin system, of course. You can transform any spin system onto this bond spin algebra. There's no approximation there. The approximation comes, okay, so let me just go through this. When you have this transformation to bond spin variables, you can, of course, then just use kind of a Schwinger boson representation of the spin algebra. So you have singlet bosons and triplet bosons, and there's a constraint on the number of bosons, as we also learned from Claudius. and then you can plug all that into your spin model. And the generic spin model that you get from that is a dimer gas of these singlets and triplets, which interact between different bonds. So there is a part which is just the trivial diagonal on the bond, counting the the triplets and the singlets, and there's an interaction part which mediates interactions between the various dimers. That is non-local. Well, this is local in terms of the bonds. And of course, this thing here, I mean, don't look too deeply into this structure. It's just that you have four particle interactions there. That's all I'm saying. And the four particle interaction just vanishes exactly at that point. Delta is equal to 1. That's what is happening. And that is the guideline, is then simply to go and expand out all this thing around the limit of full occupancy of the singlet in small fluctuations, like we're used to from Holstein-Primakov transformations in linear spin wave theory. And from that, you get a dispersion of elementary excitations on that system, which is somehow related to the linear spin wave type of approximation. I'm going to comment on in what sense this is related. This method has been, I think, pioneered for two-dimensional systems by Andrei Chubukov already prior to HITC, but there are other names which have done other approximations to that. So now that I have fixed the notation and what I'm doing with the spin system, let me just briefly tell you, assess the quality of such an approach. I mean, I would like to know how good that is and how well that compares with things that we know. So let me take the purely one-dimensional system first without and play around in this phase diagram tuning alpha and delta and checking on the properties of this theory. Yeah? So what I'll do first, I'll look for the ground state energy. Right? That's the first thing you might want to take a look at. So this is just 1D. Forget about that. First thing I have to do is I have to excuse myself for this J1 here. In the paper there, we had a J1, which was going like 1 plus minus delta relating to a dimerized J. So J tilde, say 1 and 2, right? So we're mixing up now notations, but that doesn't matter because I always give a reference on that view graph, so you don't have to care about what J is. I'm really talking, just giving a reference here. So the J1s that I'm having here are not the J1s in the first view graph. They are simply the undimerized values of the exchange coupling constant. So the first thing is the ground state energy. If you compare that to, for example, the beta anwärts, you can see that this is what you get from the von Boson type of approach. This is what you get from the beta, and that's in one dimension. So we're now down at this point in the phase diagram, looking at the ground state energy. Okay?
Yeah, but how do you get these numbers with the von Boson? You've made some sort of approximation with
Hamiltonian
and so on. Oh, okay. When you started with
that was on this. Okay, sorry about that.
Yeah, so what did you do with this Hamiltonian to get that?
Yeah, you just, once you have this thing, you go about calculating the ground state energy. You have a quadratic Hamiltonian in the operators, and you just can calculate the ground state energy. This is what I said. I do what is, I fully condense the singlet mm-hmm. on the bonds. Mm-hmm. Then I do an expansion like the linear Holstein-Primakov approach. Mm-hmm. And then I calculate the ground state energy. Okay?
So you start with function here as the first term that you wrote.
No. I need to include terms from here. Because there are quantum fluctuations of the type. You know that when you have this, there are terms of this type. T dagger. Yeah. Which come in from here. From that term. Right? But that's a technical detail. It's a technical detail. So you don't stop at the first term.
Is it different from what Alex called this?
I think that he is essentially doing the same thing. Right? It's essentially the same thing. This paper has been out before Sushko's paper. Just so.
But with this, then,
because it, you would say that the excitations for the spin a half undynamized chain would be triplet. I mean, you get the right ground state energy, but
right, you have right. No, I'm just telling you that we're now trying to just explore what happens when you push this to the limit.
Right, sure.
I'm not claiming that this describes the beta solution. I'm just trying to tell you what you get if you compare it to various limits. Okay? And you can, of course, also look into the ground state energy as a function of the dimerization, starting from that point where the thing is exact, right, down to a very small delta, and compare that with numerical dimerization. And so you see that it does quite well until you hit dimerizations of the order of 2% or so. And that's not a miracle, because then you're very far off the fully dimerized point, and you wouldn't expect this theory to be very well. But it does quite a nice job up here. Now, you can also play around with the thing as a function of the frustration. Then, of course, you are already very far away from this fully dimerized point and just walk on that line. Now, the scale here is expanded by already one order of magnitude, so we're talking about percent effects now, percent effects. And you can see that this is VMRG and exact dimerization results versus the ground state energy that you would get from an approach like that. And you can see that there are errors on the order of a percent or so in the ground state energy. Okay? Already being very far away. Now, there's one further point I want to make. You can be so bold as to look into the... just compare the dispersion with the lower edge of the Deklozo-Pearson continuum, of course. And if you do that, the ratio is off by 10% for all k vectors. So that's different as a linear spin wave theory. A linear spin wave theory would give you 1.6 or so, so would be off by 60%. So that's different.
The
k dependence is completely the same. It's just you get if you plot it, it's a square root of the sine of k versus pi over 2, the sine of k. So you compare these two numbers, and that this 1.4 and that this 1.5. So
S of q and omega, I guess, quite different than what you expect.
I have a figure for S of q and omega, and we can look at it. S of q and omega looks like this. You have a continuum, and you have a triplet.
But energy,
like Sorry. This is as a function of k. I'm plotting regions where S of k and omega has spectral weight. Okay. And this is the triplet dispersion that I've been giving you.
Is this a finite gap or zero gap?
There's a finite gap here.
The dispersion is not 5k.
No, this is for finite delta. Oh, no. I mean, here you get just one shard mode plus some stuff that is up here, right? And the weight of that goes to zero if you crank delta to zero. So the continuum disappears in that approximation if you crank delta to zero, right? But we can talk, I have figures up and I can show you what the continuum looks like. This is for a finite gap. This is for finite gap. And the continuum comes from the fact that the spin operator is not really the same as these von Boson operators. So there is some mixing in of a continuum of scattering states there. But I don't have to figure with you, which I can show you if you want. Okay, so much for the ground state energy. Yeah, maybe just, I mean, if you do linear spin wave theory, because that was this question, if that is related to linear spin wave theory. If you do linear spin wave theory, you just have a factor of 1, which comes from coordination number times 1/2 of the spins. That is the difference. Now you can play this game also for the spin gap. Right? So you can look at the spin gap, and there we start to see when this kind of approach starts to fail, and where you should be careful about it. Okay, but just put that away. So what this U-graph shows is two views of the spin gap. So this the triplet at k is equal to zero as a function of the dimerization and the frustration. So again, I'm going off that point pretty far down to zero to the isotropic point, and I'm also going along that diagonal for this figure and for that figure. So first, we know from Cross and Fisher for very small delta, we should get a two-thirds dependence. And obviously, you're not going to get that from a linear spin wave type of approach, which always has a square root in. So you get a square root dependence at small delta, but the overall dependence up to the point where the thing gets exact is, again, I mean, you can judge by yourself looking at the diagram what the kind of spin gap is you get as compared to exact ionization. This is a third-order perturbation theory by Harris, and this is some other way of treating bond operator theory. Now, you can look at the spin gap as a function of the frustration, and this is actually really where then you can see that you are far off the limit where the system is more or less treated exactly by this approach. So when you go along the alpha axis and plot the spin gap as a function of delta, this is a fourth order expansion, just fourth order plane perturbative expansion done by Uhrig. This is some other way of treating bond operators. I'm happy to comment on that. This is our way of treating it. And these are DMRG calculations. It's also interesting to see that DMRG calculations can differ. This is these are just two DMRG calculations by White and Tichard.
I mean, both DMRGs, they are sure they are correct.
Well, I'm not doing these calculations. I'm just citing from published work. I mean, this is a DMRG. I mean, I think consensus has been reached on this point here, in the sense that in the calculation by Tichard, too few M states have been taken into account. I think she has been taken on the order of 60 or 80 states, while these calculations go up by, I think, a factor of 10 or so in the number of intermediate states
kept. All these curves would be all one on top of the other.
Right. And so this is now where you see, and of course, this is really, I mean, just to make clear what I'm doing here, I'm facing myself, I have an approach which is okay up here, right? And I'm trying to treat something which is down here, and just telling you what would happen if you would go really all the way down here, right? We know that the things are exact up here, so I don't show you pictures up here. But that's, I just want to show you how far you can go with something.
You're
like
that. One theory is not good.
Right. That's the basic message is you wouldn't really want to treat systems which have a large frustration. You can go pretty far down here, but you have problems in going up here.
One thing with the frustration in the day one beta plot is you get a dimerization, but it's a different dimer. You've got next nearest neighbour dimerization.
No, I mean, I can comment on the physics. The physics is very easy. The physics is, at least as I perceive it, as follows. Up here, the ground state, the physics is different regarding the excitations. But down here, you should rather be describing the system as solitons, which have some binding to them. While up here, you can talk about the system as really bond spins that have some hopping. And we are treating them all the way down here as bond spins that have some hopping, and so we're not getting the...
So why wouldn't you have the phase problem when you go down the phase? I mean, physics near the Heisenberg model is also that of which are actually more complicated.
Yeah, I mean, this is the... Yeah, well, I mean, well, it seems to work better this way than... I mean, this is maybe far off in the alpha-delta plane than this one is. That's... I'm just trying to assess how far this will work, just to make clear, because this...
I have a question for the DMRG data.
As I understand, or as I remember these papers, they're talking just about this gap.
I think it was the
That's true. see the one up which measures, I think, the diversation compared to the what's called the sat diagonalization.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the proof, or you just compare it as another method?
I mean, that would be the truth if you believe in their finite size scaling analysis. And no, it doesn't show the two-thirds exponent, and we know that, I mean, the chains are too small that they are using. And, I mean, there is a more exact diagonalization data available nowadays, but I just wanted to give reference, so to speak, to actually the seminal work. I think these guys have been doing that more or less for the first time. Nowadays, people can do somewhat longer systems and can get the scaling better. Right?
So you can get it pretty accurately from scaling.
Yeah, I agree. I don't want to say that these are the only methods getting the gap of such a system. I could maybe put 10 more curves from many other distinguished persons which are doing similar calculations on this plot, and I would then you wouldn't see anything anymore.
When you come to the second one,
this is more or less what should be very close to the truth. Right?
Okay, and the second one, which has to do with the frustration,
yeah.
Does that method do good in both cases, or
yeah,
it doesn't matter?
Yeah, it does good. If one believes that these things are sorted out, then the lower curve should be the truth.
Another question. In the absence of frustration, if I start from the delta equal one point, then the spectrum is completely discrete, right? Because I just count.
Absence of frustration at delta. Yeah.
Now, it should take a while if I decrease delta from one before the spectrum has a continuum, right? At delta equal one, I just have
yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So it's a complete discrete ladder of.
That's right. That's
so
right.
I just count the number of
that's
frequencies
right.
that we have excited
right.
in each.
Right. That's
yeah.
right.
So if I decrease it, I should get width to all this spectral
right.
state. So it should take a while before I really get
right.
to the continuum.
Oh, but you have any dispersion in the
other? Yeah, that's it. The triplet remains shy, but the above that you have a very tiny continuum which has a very tiny width, so to speak, and that is what happens. I should have brought this figure of the continuum down. I can, if we have it.
Shouldn't I have more gaps up there?
There would be a gap in the part of the continuum.
The sequence of gaps should still persist.
Yeah, well, what happens is there'll be the two particle states will be discrete when the numbers are coupled, and a couple together will have a small dispersion.
Yes, that's right. Okay. So.
Okay, so here with the preliminary still. Okay. Now, in the discussion, we heard that we should be wondering about interchain interactions, and we have, of course, done so. Just want to flesh this model on once more. So now we are talking about an extension of this to a system that has interchain interactions and comes closer to copper-germanate. Right? So the model that I will be using now is one of these dimerized and frustrated chains, but I'm using more than one. I'm using interchain-coupled chains, right? The huge number of exchange paths that you see on this figure is not so large after all. You have so to speak, strong dimers, weak dimers, and then next nearest neighbor exchange. And between the chains, you have two, distinctly different exchange paths, which essentially go back to a work by Braden. He has been giving first evidence of these exchange paths, and the experimental evidence on this kind of staggering pattern comes from Hirota. And so I'm using this this model now here for the 2D copper-germanate. And just plug in this bond operator technique and see what comes out. What comes out is the following. You may compare inelastic neutron scattering data on these systems with the dispersion of the triplet that you get from the bond operator approach. Right? The main message on this view graph is just that because of the interchain coupling, you get a lifting of the degeneracy along the c-direction in the Kolpe-Jarmann net. This is a point, I think, that has been made first by Götzoli. And the data is due to Vigneault. Now, I don't want to bother you with the details of the calculation. You just crank this bond operator technique crank, and out you get a dispersion, and you can try some fitting to the neutron data. Right? The fitting is not done in a very controlled fashion. I'm just taking the lowest and the highest point, and I'm not fiddling around a lot, and just give the number of J values and frustration values. And the general message of such fitting procedures is that the frustration comes out too low, far too low as compared with, say, comparison to thermodynamics, bulk thermodynamics, and one-dimensional systems, between bulk thermodynamics and one-dimensional systems. There's a large error bar on this alpha that can be that is of the order of 0.1. So you can be as high as 0.16, but you can never be at 0.35. No, I mean, this is a technical point, and I didn't want to waste too much time on it. I think that the reason why all these approaches give too low an alpha value resides in the fact that it is very hard to get the gap due to frustration small enough.
So it's a problem with the calculational technique?
I would suggest it's a problem with this calculational technique. And the better you go with some approach to get the frustration dependence of the gap, the larger the alpha will get. And I think this is also an indication that you get from series expansion. So the farther you go out in the series expansion, the larger the alpha value gets in such fix. But still, as I got from your talk, it is still below the 0.35. There's an error bar on it that now goes from 0.25 to 0.35. In this case, it would be something between 0 and 0.16. So I think this really pushes the limit, so to speak, of this calculation regarding the frustration parameter dependence. Right? I just want to make this clear. But this is fiddling with parameters. I mean, the physical message is that you can get the B dispersion out very nicely. So you can see that the system is more than one-dimensional, and that ratio of interchain and intrachain couplings fits nicely into the frame that has been given, for example, by Gertzma and Komsky's calculation. Now, so much for the linear theory. We can go beyond the linear theory. Beyond the linear theory, you can again start to explore this diagram in various directions. I don't want to do that in all directions. I just want to take one of them because that is of a certain experimental interest. So I want to show what happens when you go beyond the linear theory in that direction. So you discuss ladder systems now. You're discussing ladder systems now. What happens is, physically speaking, very simple. You get interactions of these triplets. The interactions are the following. There's this hardcore constraint which tells you that you can't have two triplets on a site. That is more or less an artifact, I would say, of this method. If you do this whole procedure variationally in terms of wave functions, you don't have to worry about this hardcore, but we have to. Right? Second, there's an attraction, or better speaking, an interaction of these bond triplets now on the ladder. When they come nearest neighbor, they scatter off each other. So there's a scattering between the triplets. In the low density limit, which we are, because we have a dimer ground state to start from, and we look at, say, two particle excitations, this is a problem that can be solved exactly. It's just a two particle problem to solve. And that's why you can do that also with wave functions. We have done so. The message is essentially the following. You have three ways to combine these triplets, a singlet way, a triplet way, and a quintet way, and they all interact in some sense, giving rise to two bound states and one anti-bound state. You can either do that within this bond operator technique, where you always have to, at the end of the day, push this hardcore constraint to infinity. So this is only a technical remark. You just solve the two-particle scattering matrix. Or you can treat the latter systems just using the spin algebra and check the two results, which fully agree. So there is no difference between the two. So the parameter lambda, which is now here, is just this ratio of the inter-rung and intra-rung coupling. So this is in our notation, the J3 to the J1. And we are looking at small J3s, so small intra-rung coupling. But why should one be interested in that? Let me first show you these bound states so that you get a feeling. Now this here is, so to speak, the two triplet continuum on the ladder. I'm just showing that you have these three states. So one singlet, one triplet, and one quintet. Here I think we still have differences, for example, to Oleg's work. Oleg doesn't have this one in his paper. And I think we also have a difference on that dispersion here. But I think we can sort that out in this here. So why would one be interested in that? Because it has experimental consequences, and that's why I want to tell this to you. The experimental consequences is that you can measure such things. And why can you do that? Because certain ladder compounds allow, so this is just the same figure, which is not as nice as the other one. There are certain ladder materials where you can go in with a photon, for example, these strontium oxide systems, you can go in with a photon and couple to the magnetic exchange. Right? You need some polarizable orbitals out there to hit the system with a photon. What you then generate is a coupling of one photon to two magnons and one phonon. And this is what the photon does when it hits the lattice. So you have some absorption process where you excite a two triplet one phonon excitation. And with that, you can experimentally check at least on the singlet channel of the two triplet excitations. This process has been suggested first for the cuprids, but you can readily generalize it to these chain systems. So we have done so and calculated our optical response functions for such systems. And the nice thing about it is that you can see a clear signature of the singlet bound state in the optical absorption. Okay? This is with an experimental broadening on it. If you want these things to be completely sharp, there's a Van Hove singularity out there. Okay? But, I mean, probably this is not really of interest. So there's a Van Hove singularity due to this maximum. And the remaining part of the two-particle continuum is very small. It's almost not seen in this calculation. So almost all of this comes from the bound state. Now, why are we doing such a calculation? But because in for chains, such an experiment has been carried out. So for the simple strontium copper oxide chain, this experiment has been done. And of course, there the spectrum is very different. You just make two spin-on excitations. So you would see a two spin-on continuum and no bound states. This is just a phonon. And the thing that we would like to suggest is that the same experiment should be redone on the ladder compound, because there the spectrum would be very different. You would see a gap, first of all, and then you should see something that is related to the bound state. And talking to the experimentalists. Okay. This is a technical point. If you look into you can fairly well nowadays predict the spectral shape of the two spin on continuum for the 1D chain. And from that, you know, integrating over Q, that there should be a log singularity there, which is a Van Hove that is due to essentially the cosine type of structure of the band. But that would give you a cusp singularity. So if you do things a little better, then you get a log singularity. The authors do not specify if this is a phonon that is merely optically active, but this could also be just a phonon that is optically active, or if it is a phonon that is related to this process. So it could just be a phonon absorption because it's optically active.
How I am sure that also only magnetic absorption here or spinon absorption, but not in our
the energy scale is J and the width is J. Okay. And it's a huge effect.
Uh-huh.
This is 1,000 K, on the order of 1,000 K here. You look into this. You look. No. You look. K. We're talking. Yeah. K.
What about then the energy gap? Well, an electronic structure can provide you with that scale. So what's the energy gap then? It's an insulator.
It's an insulator.
Okay, so how big is the gap?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I simply don't know the number. It is bigger than the number. It is out here somewhere, but I can't give you a number.
Well, what might be bigger? That's 1.5 to.
Yeah, but this is one electron volt. This is one electron volt here, right? And you have to think in terms of pi over 2 times J times 2, because this is a 1, so to speak, this is the lower bound of the continuum.
Q, J is 1 tenth of it.
It's on the order of 1,000, 2,000 K.
Yes, which means 1 tenth of a V.
Yeah, and so if you, and this is 0.5.
Yeah, you have near V.
Yeah, but you have to multiply by this. This is already 1.5, and then times 2.
Yeah,
so this is 6.
That's 3.
Yeah,
J is 0.2
EV.
Yeah.
J is 0.2.
So this is claimed to be the best way to determine J.
Yeah. And
you have such a sharp cut.
To my understanding, this is the first time that spinons have been seen in optics. So I consider this experiment as very, very interesting.
So the main evidence is basically the form, the shape, the cut.
There is some
also a theoretical calculation.
Yeah, there are two out. By Nagaoza, one, which just takes the XY model, and then there's one by Lorenzana and Eder. And they do a little bit of better on the two spinon continuum. And this is essentially just the form that you get.
The fit is nearly perfect.
Can I ask about the physics once again? The phonon, which is relevant here, also itself has a dispersion.
Yeah, oh well, this is, you make the assumption that the phonon is essentially optic. Essentially, it's an optical phonon that you look at.
It looks like there's one sharp phonon peak, and the continuum.
The physics is just the phonon is a momentum absorber. It's a momentum absorber. So the only thing that the phonon helps you is to integrate over k-space, so that you can match energy and momentum conservation with the light.
Some Einstein phonon.
Right. Which is to a certain degree justified.
Yeah, I was wondering if I should see the width of this phonon branch.
No. At present, I don't think so. At present, I mean, No. You misunderstand. This is exactly the point. It's not that Q is equal to zero. So you have the. So the light hits the system. At Q is equal to zero. I think this is an interesting question, because if the phonon would have substantial dispersion, then obviously the log would be gone here.
Yes.
The bond would be immediately gone because you integrate on it. And so I think this is an indirect proof of the fact that if all this is okay, then the phonon has essentially no dispersion on an energy scale at least comparable with J on that energy scale. But that is turning things around.
There may be some strong matrix elements.
Yes, I agree. The matrix elements are kept in the theory, actually. You calculate the Q dependence of the matrix element. It's important. Okay, so now I have more or less wasted nearly all of my time on the spin dynamics, but as I already told a little bit about the carrier dynamics, I might speed up on that. Okay. So just to get you on track again, this is one view graph which some of you have seen, and I just want to put it on once more, because this is essentially all of the idea which is behind. Now that we have this treatment of the spin system, and you can...
What can this Bolden dispersion, it's not known?
I would very much like people to sit down that can do, for example, frozen phonon calculations,
sure.
Take the ladder material and calculate this matrix element. I mean, we have simple exchange path models where we just do super exchange that depends on electric field and position of lattice coordinates, and then we expand out to lowest order to get this matrix element. But I think one can surely do better than that. I mean, that will give you the gross K dependence, so the form factor that Pascal was talking about, but it's not going to give you a good estimate on the numbers of these effective charges which are in the problem. So there's an effective charge, of course, which defines this vertex, the strength of that vertex. And we don't know that very good. So that would be very interesting to have a number of that. Okay, so now let's come to this third portion, and I'll try to be brief again on that. So the main idea now is that we understand how, or that we have some approximate way of treating the spin dynamics. We want to put in carriers into the system. So this is showing now the typical or the type of processes that you have to expect once you start doping a dimerized spin system. So you place in a carrier at some site on the bond. Each bond has a label like L, has two sites, each of which can be occupied by one carrier. We just want to look at a single carrier in the system. And the carrier starts to move. And it moves by either leaving the singlet background completely as it was before. It can do so in a resonating valence bond or spin liquid environment. It can't do so in a spin polarized background, in a nail type of background, but it can do in a spin liquid background. It can hop by exchange of the triplet, by exciting the triplet. So it leaves a triplet here and flips its spin. So this is a triplet then here. It can flip the direction, it can flip its direction and excite the spin also via exchange. So there are two energy scales of the problem, J and T. And of course, it can do various other things like hopping a triplet without changing its spin quantum number, or with exchanging its spin quantum number, and it can do that again on an energy scale T or on an energy scale J. So you have on the order of six different vertices, both for nearest and for next nearest neighbor hopping. And within our bond operator theory, now that can readily be absorbed. What we do is we get an effective Hamiltonian, which describes now the coupling of the one-particle states on the electronic one-particle states on each rung or a dimer, namely, say, a left and a right fermion, to these triplets in the system. And there are just various diagrams to describe the hopping processes that can occur. Either direct propagation in the singlet background with emission of a triplet, with emission of two triplets, but without spin flip, or with emission of two triplets and with a spin flip.
Is it relevant what orbital? And there is only one orbital for the...
In our case, there are two orbitals in the sense that each dimer has two sites. So you have a but if you think in terms of an electronic model, each site has just one orbital. And these are D electrons. We're talking about D electrons, always D electrons. Yeah. Okay. Now we treat, so obviously there are, as I said, six different, I've already boiled that down to four different types of excitations. The first one resembles simply propagation in the resonating, if you want so, valence or spin liquid background without any inelastic processes, while the last three ones, so to speak, resemble inelastic scattering of the triplet excitations. You can show, simply by considering these graphs, that one of the, so this is all technical, and to go through that very briefly, you can show that the last one of them is small compared to the second, that one of the two triplet graphs is small compared to the other one. Now, with the two triplet emission graphs at present, we have to do gross simplifications because we don't know how to incorporate them in our self-consistency procedure. At present, we are working on that. So at present, what we do is we take all diagrams of this type and collapse the vertex onto a point. So we take two triplet emissions in a mean field fashion. The single triplet emissions are treated self-consistently by a method that has proved to be quite efficient, at least in nail type of systems. So we iterate, so to speak, the first loop. Well, this is just like a self-consistent Born approximation up to infinite order until we have convergence. That can be done numerically on pretty lengthy chains with many frequency points. The difference to the TJ case is that now we have a 2x2 matrix structure due to these dimer electron configurations, and that there is dispersion already without spin fluctuations in the business. So now I'm going to show you spectral functions. One picture some of you have seen already in this discussion, but for those of you which haven't seen it, I want to put it on once more. You can look for spectral functions. This is now electron hole inverted, so that the first electron removal state is at the largest energy. This is just the electron spectral function as a function of momentum for various frequencies. And as you can, for two different values of J over T on a system that has no frustration and only dimerization, such that the spin gap is 0.2 of the value of J. That is what we're looking at. And so you can see that at pi over 2, the system has a clearly developed quasi-particle pole, and it has two branches of excitations extending out in K space, roughly in a cosine-like fashion. You can compare that to exact dimerization for small systems. So you do the same kind of... So this is shown down here. There are now two spectral functions. One is exact dimerization. The other one is this diagrammatic theory for a system with just 20 sites. And you compare the spectral functions. And I think that at least roughly these things agree. You have a quasi-particle at the first electron removal state in the higher frequency branch. And the lower frequency branch is pretty broadened out and picks up weight as you go along the Brillouin zone until you reach pi. The same thing happens here. It picks up weight until you reach the upper part of the Brillouin zone, pi, while this one dives in weight. Now, we can show that indeed a quasi-particle must exist, but you can also look at figures like this, which tell you how these bands really look in K space. So this is now the first electron removal state downwards. And this is in an electron notation. So you see a quasi-particle type of pole in the first electron removal state, while the upper branches get strongly washed out. So again, this is the bare dimer dispersion of these two electrons. Why is there a quasi-particle? This is one more technical view graph, and then there'll only be figures left. I want to briefly comment on why there is a quasi-particle. This is very simple. The reason is that if you look to lowest, say, to first loop order into the one-particle self-energy, there's always going to be, at the point pi over 2 in the spectrum, because of the spin gap, there's going to be a finite frequency gap in the solution in trying to find a real solution to the Green's function pole and where the spin fluctuation spectrum picks up. And that will always be the case as long as the spin gap is finite. And so you can convince yourself that this argument carries through the self-consistency procedure. So if you plot the bare dimer bands, you will always find a certain range of k-space values where there is a real solution defining a quasi-particle in that system. And that carries on through the self-consistency procedure. Now, you can look at the quasi-particle weight as a function of the spin gap. There is one view graph I've shown already, so I'll go with the other one. of course, there are two parameters that you can crank. One is the gap, and the other one is the value of J. So you can look at the quasi-particle weight as a function of J and as a function of the gap. As a function of the gap is on this new graph. What you see here is just the spectral functions at the point pi over 2 for various values of the spin gap in this spectrum. What we do is we just extract the weight of the pole as a function of this gap size. And as you see, as the gap closes to zero, the weight of the quasi-particle drops. This is what you should expect, because at delta is equal to zero, the system should not have quasi-particles left over. And so this is exactly what we see. This is just another set of parameters. So it's the same story. Just finally to mention that, of course, with all these parameters at hand, we can play a game. Namely, we can go continuously from a chain to a ladder. And this is just the last zebra I want to put on here. This is what happens when you take this diagram, the alpha-delta diagram, look at the points in k-space as a function of frequency where you find spectral weight, and we go from a dimerized chain, essentially, up to a ladder in the delta alpha plane, and look at the spectral functions. So the ladder spectrum is something that has been investigated with similar methods by Robert Eder, and we agree on that point. And we can now just go up through this diagram and look at the spectral function as we go up here. And of course, we finally recover the chain result. This is just a game that you can play. So concluding this last and very brief part on the spectral function thing, I think that there are many open questions that we can now go and continue to study with this method. We can switch on a magnetic field, so we can discuss what is going to happen with the quasi-particle weight as a function of the magnetic field. We also have to think about the two triplet emission graphs, because we think that they might have an influence on the quasi-particle weight as a function of delta. And we will also continue on this bound state business regarding the optical absorption, because we think that one can also say something about the field dependence of such experiments, not regarding the optical absorption, but regarding other experiments that can be done there. Okay, thank you.
Is it possible to extend this line to a singlet approach to the Swan-Hahn system?
Yeah, of course. And actually, work has been done along that line, I think. One is, for example, Oleg Sushkov, which has tried to incorporate resonant phonons in such a business. And of course, then you can look at triplet phonon self-energies and phonon triplet self-energies. So essentially, just have a phonon and scatter off two triplets. And you can look at this, of course, very conveniently in the resonant regime. And then you can look at Fano line shapes, for example. That is something that, for example, for the Raman scattering would be very interesting to use this approach and look at the Fano line shape of the...
Is it correctly a three-dimensional
system? None that I know. This calculation by Sushkov is a one-dimensional one. So he uses... Actually, he doesn't even look into the chain. He has some frustrated ladder. But always going to that direction, that once you have this set up, you can just either choose ladder or frustrated chain, whatever you like.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's exactly, I think that's exactly the way that this work on this frustrated ladder has been going. So just take dynamic, make this thing dynamical, and then your Hamiltonian just has a term where the triplet, where a phonon hits two triplets. You can also have a vertex in the calculations of that type. And you could do this here 3D and keep this like 1D. Yeah, you can do that.
maybe this is what you meant by the existence of quasi particles, but I would imagine that, let's say, mechanically you have a frustrated system where the spin just don't know which way point, and in that field the electron moves. And then in one dimension in particular, you would think that the electron could get localized.
And oh, yeah.
The question of localization and delocalization mm-hmm. of the carrier is that an interesting topic to you?
People have been thinking about this localization of carriers business in magnetic systems in the framework of having nail backgrounds. There, of course, once you start moving the particle, you have this ladder of bound states, and you can try to delocalize them by means of transverse fluctuations. But then you delocalize them, and at the end of the day, you have something like quasiparticles. So here you start from a representation which has quasi-particles due to the spin liquid background already built into.
So here, basically you have pre-localized electrons.
Right. But I can show in what sense a quasi-particle disappears. I mean, that I can show. This is the way in which the quasi-particle in such calculations disappears. When you look at these calculations, okay, it's all on this new graph. You can consider the quasiparticle as a function of J, keeping, so to speak, for example, the gap fixed. And then you can just let J go to zero. So make your spin modes infinitely soft, for example. This is what you can do. And in that limit, you hit models which are well known and which have been studied severely, I think, which are the so-called T models, where there is no magnetic energy scale left. And in such models, I think the generic structure is that there is no quasi-particle. And this is also what you see in such models. But the quasi-particle disappears in the sense that the weight of this dominant pole simply decreases and decreases and decreases until you find spectral functions for various values of K which have some dispersive feature. But there is no sharp pole left. So they are completely incoherent with some K dependence. And usually what happens, as I understand it, is that these structures strongly depend on the type of magnetic background that you put in. So if you start from, for example, a totally disordered background, you get something different than from an RVD type of background like here, or a nail background, or what have you. But this is the way in which the quasi-particle usually disappears.
When you had these pictures of when you went from the chain to the ladder, standard chain.
Oh, yeah.
I think this is black one here.
Yeah.
So what is exactly your choice there?
Okay. I'm showing regions. Okay, these are contour plots of the spectral function as a function of momentum going from zero to pi. So on the ladder, everybody, I think, has some acquaintance with this spectrum. You have two cosine bands, a bonding and an anti-bonding band. And there's some scattering in between them, which you see from this figure. So there are, for example, this mold appearing, which is, of course, not there when you just have it.
Related to what? This is the carrier.
These are the electrons.
Okay, so usually the bands are coming from my world. Related and depend only on the geometry.
Yes.
Right? So the geometry dependent. So you would go from a chain to a ladder, you put any potential self-consistent or self-consistent, you get something similar to what you come out after you do the same thing. What you don't know is the character of the band, that is, which are the important orbitals. Mm-hmm. Now, here you go from something that is a change where you can have, I don't know, dx squared or some kind of symmetry or some kind of character of that band. And you go to the other one, but you always start as Balasaphio from the same D state. So the character there is the same in both cases.
Yes.
Is that so?
Yes, it's always a D electron. It's always a D electron in some sense. But But
it was important that, you know, in this candidates, you know, it was dx squared minus y squared.
Yeah, but here this is a model. Maybe I'm not getting the question. This is a model calculation. So we have one orbital per side. And this kind of a dispersion is.
If you don't worry about it now. But in the real world, there might be magnitude.
So starting from up or from down, your ingredient, it could be different. So you're mapping them, not only the geometry deciding this.
No. No.
I mean,
No. This is this one view graph I had in the discussion. And I left it out because of time here. There's a very important point. I'm not very important, but it's an important point to understand this. Here in this dispersion, there are things entering which have nothing to do with the geometry. They have to do with the singlet background that you're working on. In fact, if you don't have a singlet, so what you would see if you just do TJ, if you just do a tight binding model calculation, the lower figure would look exactly like that. Okay? If you then go to the chain, so there's a pi over 2 phase shift between this and that, due to the fact that hopping from one edge of a singlet to the other edge of the singlet gives you a factor of minus 1 when you hop along the chain. But when you have a ladder, you have the singlets oriented in that way. So you always hop from one edge of the singlet to the corresponding edge of the singlet. So there is no factor of minus 1 involved in the hopping amplitude. So while the hopping down here you can essentially think of as being geometry determined, the hopping up here strongly resembles the fact that you have a singlet, a dimer singlet background on which you hop. So there is some ingredients which has nothing to, neither something to do with the geometry nor with the orbitals, but with the magnetic background, with the type of magnetic correlations that you have in the problem.
Assuming the low energy, you can describe the gapless charge excitation by closing the vision system. Mm-hmm. Is that consistent with calculation? Should be able to try to exactly measure this time.
We haven't done so yet. But still, I would hope that one could say something about. I mean, you don't have. I mean, obviously, this is not a Latente liquid. As long as you put in just the same. Yeah, you have a gap in the spin spectrum,
yeah.
Right? And you're talking about the charge part.
Yeah. So it's probably by a gap by a free charge with a.
Right. So it's like a Luther Emery type of liquid that you have here. Yeah. It's also tricky in the sense that when you start doping the system, there should be some crossover between. I mean, once you should see just the Luttinger liquid, right? And so I don't really know if.
Well, as soon as you've got the spin excitation,
right. But somehow the spin excitations would strongly depend on the doping in some sense once you start doping.
Yeah,
I agree. I agree. No, but it would be interesting to learn how to do that. No, we haven't done that.
Of course, some special connections are still in
mm-hmm. I was thinking about maybe getting exact results in with the magnetic field switched on, because then you can, so to speak, let two of the triplets vanish, and then you have something like an XXZ chain, and then you start doping. And maybe something, one knows something exact about that. So in the magnetic field case, you can maybe get things even simpler and then learn something about exact properties.
Just for understanding, if the calculation is done with two constraints, first of all, the exclusion of double optics,
mm-hmm.
and second, also the exclusion from the other constraint from the single triplet.
Regarding the rainbow rainbow, there is no scattering of triplets in the rainbow approximation yet. So when we do the rainbow approximation for the one particle self-energy, there is no triplet-triplet interaction there. So in that case, the triplets are unconstrained.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But that's somehow similar to what people have been doing in the TJA model.
The model, the way you write it down, it should on line number one, contain two constraints.
Right, it should contain two constraints. And in some sense, this is the same approximation that people have been doing for TJA models.
Yes.
And I agree that when you would go one step further, you should take into account triplet scattering, but that is not included.
And there was one thing I was confused about. The system here has a charge gap, right? And is this comparable to the spin gap now, or? I was confused here. Of course, you start with a system which has a spin gap. Now we inject carriers, and there is a charge gap, for example.
When you start doping the system, say with two, if you talk about chargeless, the system is charged gapless. And if you talk about spin, the system has a spin gap. So you can put, physically speaking, you can put, physically speaking, you can put, so to speak, two particles on two holes on one of these dimers and hop them without essentially any loss of magnetic energy through the system.
That's what I was hoping for, a picture if I go to the extreme limit of putting little delta equal to one.
On the ladder, one knows how to map the system to a hardcore Bose gas.
Yes.
So you can, so to speak, put two holes on the rung, and then map this to a hardcore Bose gas, or an interacting Bose gas, essentially. And that is, I think, what people have been doing.
Yeah.
How would you define a charge gap?
I would go with this old notion of putting two particles on the system, two holes on the system, and letting them move freely. So I would have massless charge modes, essentially. Why to excite?
So how would you define it? I mean, balance and Fisher, for example, have defined cases in the ladder where you have C1, S1, and C1, S0, all these phases with certain number of gapless charge modes and gapless spin modes.
Mm-hmm.
How would you define in your system?
We have one hole in there yet. I mean,
so you have one, but
We have one hole, so we would at least have to look at a density-density correlation function, right? And
but at half filling, you would say it can never have a charge gap.
It must. I mean, it must. It, at half filling, it has. But at if I would have to define.
At half filling, I mean, you know, at half filling, you add one or two holes.
If I add two holes, I have the feeling I can move them through the system with just a cosine dispersion. I can combine them to form a composite. I'm thinking in terms of the ladder now. This is where I have this picture pretty clear in mind. I put two holes on a ladder, and I can just hop them around. So they are like massless regarding their charge mode.
See, normally charge gaps come in your Martin's
vector. Right.
Your model to begin with is infinity.
Not exactly.
But you can also get a charge gap from having a charge density wave.
Right.
But I mean, in the TJA case, we know how to calculate these charge. I mean, people have been doing that. They essentially go calculate density-density response function. And that is not what we are at yet. I mean, we would have to have a theory for putting more than one. We would have to make particle hole excitations in some sense there. And then we would have to have the system doped prior to doing that, because we have a constraint of no double occupancy. Yeah.
I think the charge gap would be defined here the same way as any of the
All right, so you need to have at least an amount of holes in the system to have anything that is finite. And apart from that, the system has, of course, infinite inverse compatibility.
You said that if the dimer is changed, you put one board, the quasi particles are there.
Yeah.
But presumably, when you put finite density up.
Yeah, this is, of course, okay, yeah.
You go back to the density.
Yeah.
It would seem numerically.
There is numerical evidence for ladders where they calculate one and two hole spectra. But when these are very small systems, and you just see that the quasi-particle spectral function gets very broad, broader than with one, right? And that's the only evidence that I have for ladders. That is a calculation by Haas and Dagoto. And but this is the only that I have.
So if you have non-zero delta, you're going to the spin gap will survive finite delta. if you broke the symmetry translation by one side, I would expect you to have to stay in the spin gap phase and finally open.
But on the other hand, charge density will interact. And to that extent, it will start having the symmetry of the area. Even though there is a spin gap, which is not a structure.
Well, I mean, I think all energies are well defined description in terms of which bosons are massless and which ones are not. I think if you have a non zero delta, the non zero alternation in your Hamiltonian,
you're
going to be gapless. I think for any, well, before you do, for any finite delta, you've gapped the spin boson.
Right.
And I think if you start doping that system, if the gap is going to remain, it'll be stuck to some finite doping.
That is to put the non-fermionic could be there.
It will be associated with the charge boson.
Yeah, yeah. So
but the C1 phase and one of the Fisher.
So as soon as you have finite confirmation of force, that non-fermionic capacity should develop rather than waiting for a critical concentration.
You would suggest there's a critical concentration?
I'm saying there's no critical concentration.
No critical. No. Okay. No critical.
Well, it's possible it's going to have a security instead of a concentration, but no obvious reason I said.
Thank you, speaker again.
Yeah, the Rechnung is fully spin rotational invariant. So that's one of the nice things. No. This approach is so to speak, made to be. This is also a difference to the LCBA. It's fully spin rotational invariant. Yeah. Das ist genau drei Moden und sind alle mit dabei. Aber das sind alles so fine points, die, glaube ich, doch niemand interessiert. Nee, es ist fully spin rotational invariant. Es muss so sein, weil sozusagen das Spektrum, was man reinsteckt, ist voll rotationsinvariant. Und dann, wenn man diesen effektiven Vertex ausrechnet, dann muss man, letztendlich haben wir die so berechnet, dass wir wissen, es muss spin-rotationsinvariant sein. Und dann nehmen wir einen Prozess daraus und gucken das Matrixelement an, zum Beispiel ZZ. Ja? Und dann haben wir die Matrixelemente hingeschrieben und dann ist der Jureka hergegangen und hat einfach ein Drei-Platz-Problem genommen und hat das Brute Force diagonalisiert und geguckt, sind die alle dieselben. Okay, also das heißt, wir wissen sozusagen, das stimmt schon. Das ist also Vollrotationsinvariant. Ja. Das war so auch einer der Sachen, die ist natürlich anders in diesen alten TJ-Richtungen. Die haben halt alle eine Spinrotationsinvariant, die gebrochen ist und das ist anders.
Diese Bilder,
nochmal.
Wenn ich die Bilder so anschaue und aus der Isomerisierungsmodelle, dann guckst du immer nur auf eine Energieseite.
Ja, ach so. Das ist ja eine Einloch, das ist eine Einlochrechnung. Das ist eine Einlochrechnung. Das heißt, das chemische Potenzial ist in den Rechnungen immer so definiert, dass es da liegt. Arbitrary Energy Zero. Arbitrary. Ich meine, die Rechnung muss so gemacht werden, dass das Integral A von K, das Integral A von K und Omega, d Omega, immer 1 durch N ist, sozusagen. Wenn du für alle Ks. Ist also 0. I'm so sorry to have bothered you for such a long time. I'm so sorry. You guys can start talking about, you know, ergodicity and so on this evening.
What's your problem?
Yeah, but this was the stuff I had in the discussion anyhow, so I thought I might forget about it. No, we had a discussion. We had a discussion on Ian Affleck was up front, and he had some very interesting general points on spin pile systems. So we had somehow like three people wanting to talk. And so after 45 minutes or so, they decided that that Claudius and I had some 5 minutes left. So I flashed on like 50 view graphs in 2 minutes, and that was it. So, but I mean, this point about the Lattinger, of course, that is something that I would very much like to understand if there's any...
Because in a sense, permilliquid is very unusual in one dimension.
Right. So in some sense, I would like to understand if this one whole problem is just an academic one, or if there is a finite hole concentration, or if there is, if you can keep the quasi-particle for some delta, or what you...
Can continuously.
So you
in the sense of, yeah, finite concentration.
But there are exponents, there's a difference. You have exponents in the spectral function versus a delta function. How do you go from that to that? Or you have log singularities, if you think in terms of...
Because even naively, suppose you have this Fermi liquid quasi-particle.
Yeah.
And a very dilute concentration of them.
Yeah.
Then the weakest interaction between them will make them Lattinger liquid.
Yeah.
With an exponent which is, essential, it has a very weak dependence on the whole concentration.
Yeah.
Like e to the power of minus, some concentration.
So you think if we would do this calculation, for example, taking two holes and try to do some scattering calculation between them, we would immediately logs.
Exactly, because you get a finite phase shift in one dimension. So my prediction will be that there is a critical concentration is zero.
But for that, the spectrum of the intermediate states to do the scattering on must be gapless, right?
You are protected because it is a spin gap.
Right, this is... this is probably what I'm trying to understand. Would you suggest that there are logs immediately all over the place, say for two particles, even if you have the spin gap?
Right. It will be like Lattinger liquid without spins, which we know.
Which probably...
Already has this kind of signal.
The only thing that I can scatter off in this problem is the triplet. Right, this
is
that has a gap.
That has a gap.
So you won't get...
But on the other hand, there are hardcore repulsions among the charges. So the short-range repulsion, it's already there.
Okay.
So they are sufficient to give you the phase shift and...
Oh, I see. That is true for the latter case, then true also.
But I for the latter case and for the latter case.
For the latter case, think about it. Maybe it's true for latter case also. Yeah, that's why I think about it.
And for the latter case, we also have only, I only know of these analytic, of these numerical calculations by Tsune Tsubo and from Rice Group. But that doesn't help. I mean, it doesn't help. Sorry. So you suggest it goes gradually?
It's gradually.
Yeah.
So critical.
Because
even if you don't have hardcore repulsion in the latter case, any weak overlap disturbance from the wave functions will do the job. Of course, it may develop very gradually with concentration. Because what
is the
non-permilliquid character? Probably the exponent also.
But how would you then suggest, I mean, if I just would like to understand how you visualize. I mean, in this calculation, of course, you get a G sub omega, which has some incoherent stuff, and it has a pole.
Right.
So what happens to that pole as a function of concentration? You have a 1 over, say, omega plus I delta.
Right. Mm-hmm. So now let us think of a dilute gas approximation of this quasi-particle.
Right.
Now, this quasi-particle are basically charge-charge interaction.
Okay. So you would, this would then give log divergent self-energies.
Right, exactly. When you think about an effective theory, what is the Diophantine class of particles?
And of course, the self-energies themselves scale with the density in some sense.
Right.
So, what does it imply?
So it's an effective theory for this.
Yeah,
right.
With a density-dependent exponent in some sense.
See, the only difference from cube rates is, in cube rates there is nothing which is protecting the spin degree of freedom.
Yeah. Right. But there the story is very different then. I mean, you immediately have low energy excitations to scatter off.
I agree with you, but from a different perspective.
Okay.
No, go ahead, guys.
No.
Two against one.
Oh, I'm still on the air here.
Yeah. You've got to have a, like, a cue.